I cannot believe that you are this army's only master.
My children have no master.
They are not children, they are slaves.
But each one has a name. A heart.
A heart created by Mother.
We are creations of the One. Master of the secret fire, the same as you. As worthy of the breath of life. And just as worthy of a home. Soon, this land will be ours. Then you will understand.
No. Your kind was a mistake. Made in mockery. And even if it takes me all of this age, I vow to eradicate every last one of you. But you shall be kept alive. So that one day, before I drive my dagger into your poisoned heart, I will whisper in your piked ear that all your offspring are dead. And the scourge of your kind ends with you.
Welcome to our podcast, Those Who Wander and Those Who Wonder. I'm Penny.
And I'm Archmaester Rennie.
And I'm Jonathan.
And this is the Cast of the Rings, a podcast dedicated to the show The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime.
This episode, episode 7, we're covering The Rings of Power, season 1, episode 6, Udun.
And I want to welcome Jonathan and Rennie to the podcast. I really appreciate you guys filling in, especially on a week when Anwen isn't here. I need the backup. Jonathan, you all might recognize if you've listened to either the Andor podcast, which is going on right now on Podcastica. And Jonathan, were you on the Obi-Wan podcast as well?
I was. I first came in on the Obi-Wan, and I did one of the D episode of the Tales of the Walking Dead as well. So, yeah. Racking up a few episodes now, which has been great fun.
Welcome to the Podcastica family.
Thank you. It's an honor.
And you might know Archmaester Rennie from any of the Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon podcasts, where she is regularly our resident expert on all things George R.R. Martin.
Yes, and I'm very happy to be visiting with you here in Middle Earth today from my home in the Citadel in Old Town in Westeros.
Wonderful. We'll talk about it at the end, but the House of the Dragon podcast has been really a fun listen this year. I enjoy it a lot. What, if anything, are your experiences with Lord of the Rings? When did you first, you know, experience any of Tolkien's work, and what has been your experience since then?
Jonathan, do you want to go first?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I first read The Lord of the Rings when I was 13, after my parents got divorced, and I was sent to an all-boys Catholic boarding school, and then I was just sitting there very out of place, and this guy sitting next to me goes, "I've just finished The Lord of the Rings. Does anyone want to read it?" And he handed me over this 4-inch thick book with the image of the Black Riders from the animated movie on the cover. And it was kind of my escape and protection during those during that time, because it was a very weird time for me, and I really have a deep love for the book. And the movie certainly didn't disappoint. And when we approached the Prancing Pony and I saw the sign of the Prancing Pony in the movie, I must say a little tear came to the eye at that point. But, you know, I love the movies. I've watched them many, many, many times. And I thought they were such a great representation of it. And The Rings of Power have surprisingly been pretty good. They haven't had a lot to complain about of how it's been put forth. And but yeah, I have a deep love for the Lord of the Rings. And but I haven't read any of the Silmarillion or any of the, you know, I stopped at the appendix after about a paragraph, I think.
Similar, yeah. How about you, Rennie?
Well, when I was a young teenager, I started reading The Fellowship of the Ring, and I had to stop because the Nazgul and the orcs were so scary. They gave me nightmares. About 20 years later, I was watching the television show Babylon 5, which still occupies a fond spot in my heart. And my younger brother, in the meantime, had become a major Lord of the Rings super fan. And when I was talking with him about Babylon 5, he said, "Oh, yeah, you know, J.M. Straczynski ripped off the plot of that from Lord of the Rings." And I said, "What?" And so I went back and I read Lord of the Rings. I read it all the way through this time. It gave me zero nightmares and I loved it. And so since then, I have reread the books a couple of times, and I've also listened to the audiobook, not the BBC audio adaptation. I still have never listened to that, but just the regular audiobook. And then when the movies came out, I became a big fan of the movies, particularly the extended versions. I prefer the extended versions. You too, Jonathan?
The giving of the gifts was very important, I thought.
Indeed.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
ever since I read the books the first time, I have been waiting for the day that I can say, "I will take the ring, though I do not know the way."
Oh, nice. I suppose you could work that into wedding vows.
Yes, well, since I'm not getting married, that won't work for me. the movies really, really wanted... So now I have a sad story for you, a very sad story. The movies made me want to visit New Zealand. They were just a big advertisement for the beauty of New Zealand. And I actually had this great trip planned. The World Science Fiction Convention, WorldCon, was scheduled to be held in Wellington, New Zealand in July 2020. And I was going to go. I was signed up for a tour, which would have taken me to the Lord of the Rings sites. I would have gotten to meet Anwen. And we all know what happened to that trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a real bummer.
It's been a rough couple of years. But I must say, the podcasts have got me through the last couple of years. Listening to everyone, it's been a reliable source of comfort and community, I must say.
I agree. Well, I'm going to speak for Anwen here because I know what she would say, which is, "We'll plan a trip now and come to New Zealand and I'll show you around." I am very seriously considering it for next year. I'm on sort of a travel kick lately and I'm like, I've always wanted to go to Australia and New Zealand. And I have a friend who lives in Wollongong, Australia, who's also on my case to visit. And I'm like, I could combine those trips and be like, you know, spend like 6 weeks. It'd be really fun. We'll see.
Yeah, well, I'm a lot closer now, though, so I'm going to plan a trip to go over and see all those great locations myself. It's only a little hop across the pond.
Yeah, for you. The locations are unbelievably beautiful, and this show continues to showcase them, the same types of locations from the movies, all over New Zealand. I am sad that they're not going to be filming in New Zealand after this season. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Maybe because of the destruction of Mordor, they need to do all that in a set, but it's just not going to be as pretty.
No. Well, it's one of the leading characters of The Lord of the Rings, isn't it? It's the location, especially in New Zealand. You can really feel when they're on location.
Yeah.
And I thought, I think it's just so beautiful. And it's such a, I think I was saying New Zealand is such a young country. It really feel like it's being filmed thousands of years ago when they filmed there.
It's true. The landscape is unlike anything I'm used to in the U.S. And I've been to plenty of mountainous and cliff-type places, but the New Zealand shoreline and the ragged mountains is just different. Yeah, I got to see it. I have to do it. All right. fans, listeners, Harfoots, elves, we will be having a completely free conversation about the topics that come up during the show. Any aired episode content is fair game. So if you haven't seen this episode, you might want to wait, watch it, and come back. But anything really spoilery about the future, we put into a section we call Galadriel's Mirror, and it'll be at the end of the podcast. So it'll be really easy for you to just turn off your podcast at that point and not listen to it if you don't want to hear those spoilers. But if you want to hear them, stick around because they're fun. How'd you guys feel about, let's get into the episode. How'd you feel about this episode overall? Jonathan?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I've been loving the whole series so far, and with all the controversy before the opening, I was a bit kind of trepidatious going in, but I find that it's been really living up to what I expected and what I hoped for, and especially this episode, we got to see some great action, although I have some questions about some battle tactics and things like that, which I'll get into to later, but overall, amazing. It's just so nice to live in this world, and it's so nice to see, or you know, at least one, a couple of the threads come together to a climax, which was really interesting and great battle scenes. And it is always nice to see a charge of cavalry, especially in Middle Earth.
Yeah, beautiful, right?
Yeah.
How about you, Rennie?
I loved this episode. For me, this was the best episode of this first season so far, and I was very happy to have this episode be the one I get to podcast on, because I have many things to say about it.
Excellent. Well, that is a great introduction to, let's just get into our points. Rennie, why don't you go first?
All right. Well, my first point is Arondir and Bronwyn.
Yay.
At first, I want to say a word about Arondir and the people who hate him. I know that there has been a toxic segment of the fandom that has been hating on the Black Elves, Dwarves, and Harfoots. And I just want to say that I think Arondir is an outstanding elf. And I just want to send some love and respect to Ismael Cruz Cordoba, who is the actor who plays him, because I know that he's been getting hate on social media. To me, he is just as great an elf as Orlando Bloom. He's an awesome elf archer. I love the way elves do archery.
Yeah, the backward grip.
Yeah. And he is just as beautiful with those pointy ears.
Hmm.
And I find this outpouring of hate interesting, because in our world, there is only one hominid species, and that is us. But once, 100,000 million years ago, there were several hominid species, all of which might have survived to the present, in which case we would have a world more like Tolkien's, where there are very distinct humanoid species. Humans, elves, dwarves, Harfoots, hobbits, and even orcs are a humanoid species. And so in a story about truly divergent humanoid groups, why isn't there room for a range of skin tones within those groups? I think there should be. I'm glad to see it. And I'm just really sorry that there is this noise going on in the background. And I hope that all of these actors can insulate themselves from it to the extent possible, although I know that they must be wounded and injured by it, and so that's why I'm sending them all some love today. So that said, I was so happy to see Arondir and Bronwyn acknowledge their love for one another, but I was yelling at the screen, no, 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 don't do this before the battle, because one of you will die.
And I know, that's exactly what I thought.
and the, you know, the filmmakers know that we know this trope, and they just teased us with it unmercifully. with first Arondir and the horrible stick coming towards his eye. I hate anything with eyes, and orc blood dripping right in his mouth. Ew.
That was gruesome.
So gruesome. And then Bronwyn being wounded. But they both made it. Or did they?
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Could the volcano have killed one or both of them? I don't know.
Oh, I'll be devastated if we lose Arondir. I'm like madly in love with him. He's so beautiful, first of all, with his high cheekbones and those light eyes. It's such an amazing combination. And I love his character because he's not like a royal elf. He's not a commander elf. He's a rank and file elf, and we never really get to see those.
Yes, yes, good point.
And it is, I really love the world building, how there is those rank and file elves just scattered around Middle Earth, holding down these far flung forts for centuries, or for 70 years in this case. And it's such great world building. And I love him as well. I think he's done really well with the character and all the noise that came before everything came out. And I just decided to not look and just to enjoy the series for what it is. And I saw all those YouTube videos, but since I've started watching it, I just stopped watching them all. And everyone just looks normal to me, and everyone just seems just like a normal character. And, the Southrons, the Southrons are the Southrons. And I just think all that sort of thing is just unnecessary and probably a little louder than hopefully it really is, and that the vast amount of fans are just accepting whoever's in this. And I think everyone's doing a great job, especially him. And his skills as an archer are fantastic. I loved all of that from him. And so, yeah, I think he's a great character, and I hope none of them die either. But no. That was a large explosion at the end.
It certainly was. I'm a little worried.
I mean, we know Galadriel, Elendil, and Isildur survive because they're key figures in the future.
Yeah.
But everyone else?
How does Galadriel survive that ball of fire and rock?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just elven strength. I don't know.
Exactly.
Jonathan, you want to go next?
Yeah. I'd like to start with talking about the opening with Oren, and I just love that opening scene with the armored glove digging in the dirt to plant the Afrin seed. It was so visceral, and you could feel every grain of the earth when he was digging in there. And I find it really interesting, maybe in the context of all of that, of how he's saying that the orcs have a right to live, they have his right to live as anyone else, and he's just in his mind just fighting for them to have a place in Middle Earth. And and I found that his opening speech, when before the attack, we have endured much, we cast off our shackles, was almost inspiring as Theoden. And then they start chanting Nampat, which is death in Orcish, and I wonder if that was purposely mirrored to the Ride of the Rohirrim. And Theoden's great speech, probably one of my favorite speeches in all of movies. But I think he's such a great character, and I really find it interesting. I've always wondered about the origins of the orcs, and they seem to be obviously showing us how this happened. And that they were corrupted elves, and Galadriel at the end talked about them as the Moriondor, and the Sons of the Dark, the first elves, the first orcs, and he goes, but I prefer to be called the Uruk. And I thought it was just so dark, but a really interesting new way of looking at the orcs themselves.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Go ahead. No.
I was just going to say that particular thing about preferring to be called the Uruk, that is such a fitting Tolkien-esque kind of thing, because Tolkien actually invented the languages before he invented the story. He was an old English scholar and linguist, and he was most interested in the languages and the songs, the kind of the things that people skip over in the books often.
Yeah.
That was what was central to him. So arguing over terminology would make Tolkien's heart warm, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true.
And when he was saying, my children have no master, for each one has a name and a heart, I just found that so interesting. Because Galadriel is coming across as so hard and so vengeful, which is such a surprise for me after reading the books, because she was one of my favorite characters who came across as so loving and ethereal and generous and kind and maternal, and And here she's vengeful and spiteful and patronizing to a lot of people. And to find my sympathies almost going for the father of the orcs was a very interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, the argument or interrogation she has with Adar towards the end, when they're arguing about whether the orcs have a right to even live, I found myself really sympathizing with Adar and his point. Like, the orcs, they can't survive in the sun, and they exist whether it kind of doesn't matter their origins, because they now exist as a large group of humanoids on this planet. And so he just wants to build them a home. It's a very understandable quest, except that he has to kill all these other people to do it.
right. Apart from except that. For that part, yes.
Yeah, that part. But, you know, it's the same thing that refugees have in our world now, right? They just want somewhere to live, and some of them sort of move from country to country, being rejected, not finding a hospitable place, and it's a really sad thing when you have compassion for them. And I love that this show is showing us more of the orcs as, like, characters and less as, like, a sort of faceless horde of evil. It's just much more layered and interesting.
Yeah.
Agreed.
And it was interesting when he said at the end, it would seem that I'm not the only elf left alive that has been transformed by darkness.
Yeah.
And when you saw that the anger and vengeance in Galadriel's eyes at that point, and she was even willing to torture all the other orcs by, do you want me to take them out into the sunlight? It's interesting to see Galadriel like this, and you know, it's very different, but you know, it's been a good point of this series, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're going to get to see the journey of Galadriel becoming less warlike and more serene. Maybe by the end of the series, she'll be much more like the Galadriel we see in the Lord of the Rings movies.
I hope so, because she was one of my favorite characters from the books, and I always felt like a golden aura descending upon me when she was in the presence in the books or the film. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how it all comes to pass.
Yeah, it's only going to take her a few thousand more years to get there.
Which should be time enough, I think.
Elves change very slowly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always wanted to visit Lothlorien. The descriptions of it in the book were really magical. And in Boston, along the Charles River in October, all the leaves turn gold. That particular section of the city, everything is yellow and gold. And then if you get on the right day, a lot of them have fallen, and you can walk on a carpet of gold leaves with gold leaves ahead above you. And amazing. It's all about timing. You have to get there before the leaves have been cleaned up, but while there's still leaves on the tree. So I like keep an eye on the Charles River in October until it's like the perfect day to go for my fake Lothlorien walk. I wanted to talk first about the title of the show, of this episode, is Udun, and I looked up what that means, and it is the name of the geographical region that they're in this episode, after it gets transformed, and when Mount Doom has sort of settled and established itself in that area, it becomes known as Udun, and I looked it up, and I found this article, and normally I read articles in news, but it's appropriate here. As episode 6 reveals, Adar didn't simply want the hilt of Sauron's old sword to wield it for himself. He wanted to use it to trigger the eruption of Ur-Druin, aka Mount Doom, thus destroying the Southlands and making them a place where the orcs can live without fear of sunlight. His plan succeeds despite the intervention of Galadriel and the Numenoreans, and the episode culminates with a game-changing volcanic explosion. When the orcs realize what is about to happen, they gleefully chant the word Udun. In the Elvish Sindarin, Udun means dark pit or hell, all the kinds of places where orcs would thrive. However, it also has a deeper meaning linked to the history of Middle-earth. Udun is another name for Utumno, the first fortress of the Dark Lord Morgoth, then called Melkor. Utumno has a similar meaning to Udun. In the Elvish Kenya, it means underworld. Given the underworld connotations and Morgoth's involvement, it's clear that Utumno was a pretty nasty place. However, it was destroyed when Morgoth was defeated in the First Age. Based on the orcs' excited chants of Udun, Udun, it's clear that Adar's project was to create an Utumno 2.0. There's more in that article, so we'll link it in the show notes if anybody's interested on more details about the geography of Middle-earth.
That was great. Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah. And I think that if anyone's interested in Middle-earth, they're definitely interested in maps.
Yeah, yeah. It's a huge part of the Middle-earth. And the book reading experience was constantly flipping between the map and the story. Yeah. I feel like I want to have like a giant Middle-earth map on my wall at all times when I'm watching the show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although they do a great job of showing us the beautifully drawn maps that are probably by that calligrapher that Anwen knows, whose name I have forgotten.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes.
And I love the journey of the Harfoots last week in the last episode where they followed the map through Middle Earth. I thought that was very there were some really good map.
Harfoot footprints. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the map was, as Anwen pointed out, that map looked like it was leather instead of paper, which was a really nice image.
Right.
For the authenticity of how old this story is. So back to you, Rennie.
Okay, well, my second point, I'm have some trepidation now because I'll see what Jonathan has to say. My second point is big battle scenes.
Yeah.
Which is what I think the show is doing best, just like the films did. And this battle scene was very reminiscent of the battle at Helm's Deep in the films. And one thing that I really want to appreciate is that although it was a night battle, it was not so dark that you could not see what was going on.
I wonder what night battle you might be thinking about.
Thank you, Amazon
we were all
Prime.
With our TVs that night, weren't we? Have I got the contrast right on this? What's happening?
yes. Thank you, Amazon Prime, for not doing whatever it is that HBO does. So I have to say that particular battle that I'm thinking of, I have the DVD set, and if you watch it on DVD, it's really not dark, but on the streaming, it really is. So, but Amazon Prime is managing to stream a night battle sequence in a way that you can actually see it, which I totally appreciate.
Yeah, they used a lot of fire.
Yeah.
You know, in the story, they're using fire, but it also provided a lot of light to the scenes. It was a nice way to do that without making it. There's nothing worse than when you see a scene that's supposed to be at night and you're like, did they just film in the daytime with a blue filter?
Right.
Yeah. Stop it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. This looked real. And it's the fire that allowed them to light it in such a way that you could still see. It was beautiful.
Yeah. So I really liked the battle tactics. This is where I think Jonathan might have a different view. I love the booby traps that were used by the villagers because they're clearly the underdogs. So they're using, you know, everything that they can possibly use to their advantage.
Also, and Galadriel said you can't outstrength an orc. You have to outsmart them.
That's right. And then when the Numenorean cavalry comes in, I love the chain that they use to mow down the orcs.
Yes. Very effective.
So, Jonathan, I'm interested to know what you thought was questionable about the battle tactics.
Well,
other than this,
I thought about it too much.
When arrows start flying and people start getting shot, everybody stands around going, "Whoa, where are those arrows coming from?" Instead of diving for cover.
Exactly. Well, I thought that the design of the Elven Tower was so great, and there was so much thought into it that it could only be attacked by coming up a switchback road over a bridge and to attack the front gate, which was overseen by a couple of towers looking down where you could rain down, you know, all sorts of arrows and debris upon them. And they could only really attack four abreast. And although I loved the sneak attack with the tower and that got me and just trick shot on burning the rope through and then everything started to ping and fall apart and that big big splinter just skewering that orc, and a big, you know, reminded me of the attack when the big blocks of cars were falling and just squashing the orcs as well. I thought that was all great, but I just like, you have the most defensible position. They can only attack four at a time. Mm. You have lots of people. Mm. You've got lots of arrows. But it was still very, very satisfying. And my favorite bit was when he kicked the block of stone over the edge, which is attached to the chain, which was attached to the log, which locked the door behind him. I thought that was great.
Yeah, very mousetrap. Very Ewoks, right? The Ewoks did a lot of those like log trap things in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
And of course, Home Alone, it made me think of.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, that it's a questionable decision not to defend the tower. And the way I took that was that they were hoping that the collapse of the tower would wipe out most of the enemy, so that there would be very few left to come after them in the village. And that didn't work, but I understood that to be the intention.
Yeah, and I agree that was the intention, and it almost worked. But I know we have to have a show, and I'm like, why didn't they just all leave? I guess they're wanting to fight for their home as well. I think one of the orcs said they must have scarpered, which is a great saying. And when it did collapse, it did take out all the orcs that were on the path. But you're right, they must have held back a second force second force of reinforcements.
Yeah, I guess they really underestimated just how many orcs there are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jonathan, right, after hearing you say they must have scarpered, I think that you should play an orc on season two.
I have to see. Speak to Anwen and see if there's any further casting going on in New Zealand.
Yeah, the orcs are delightful. They also add little bits of comic relief in an otherwise very serious show. It's nice to have their silly speech and snarly ways. Like, they're just this side of too comical, but they're still scary.
Yeah, and very East End London as well. But in the village, I thought the orc head on a spike was a little spiteful of the villagers. I thought it was maybe a little out of character for them.
Yeah, I don't think Bronwyn was behind that.
No.
Maybe that old guy who told Arondir he was not a little bit brave. Maybe he didn't.
But the battles was one of my points as well. And I was just thinking of like when Bronwyn and the other woman was standing behind the cart, and they're trying to spark up the thing, and I'm like going, oh no, hasn't anyone seen Survivor? Do you know how hard it is to light a fire on coal with a piece of flint? And I'm like, they're never gonna light this. And then the woman that was with her was unarmed, so there was no way. But luckily, Bronwyn with her sickle managed to take care of things and get that into the get that rolling down the hills set on fire.
Yeah, she's wicked with that thing.
Yeah.
If that's one of your points, Jonathan, let's just go there and finish it up the battle discussion.
Yeah, well, I loved that there was no holding back, and everyone was involved in the battle, men and women. And so it was really tough to see kind of people that are usually, you know, in the keep, just taking arrows, being cut in half, being run through. And it's a very difficult image to see, is the villagers just being run through by these orcs that have never held anything, you know, greater than probably a spoon to attack, or a cooking knife or something. It's not a kids series, this one. It was very, very violent, and then there was a lot of horrible deaths that were being shown. And I thought the kill box was a really good idea, how they had them surrounded by the fire, but But they managed to fight their way out a little too easily, I thought. And so, although this was a good backup plan, again, I thought, why didn't they just stay in the tower? They could have, you know, held them off for ages. But then I loved Arendir's fight with the large orc. I thought that was a classic battle, and every moment of that was gorgeous to look at, including the black blood, you know, dripping into his eye. And he did a lot of work with a large splinter, I thought.
Yeah. What about after the Numenoreans showed up and heroically, you know, valiantly saved them in dramatic fashion at dawn? It was really beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, here's one question that I have. The Numenoreans sail, arrive, land, and then they immediately go into a mad dash gallop.
I had that question too.
Did they know that they needed to get there in a hurry?
And like to the exact spot. Yeah.
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 Were they just galloping because it looks so good? I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Like when you're in that beautiful scale armor and the sun's rising, I don't think you'd be in a bit of a trot. I think it'd be just sort of like, let's just take a nice canter across the field.
I think the horses had been cooped up on the ships and they needed a good run to, you know, work the kinks out of their legs.
Yeah.
I love that Galadriel is in the front.
Yes.
Apparently elves can make horses go faster than humans can, and that she has the only white horse in that huge army. There's hundreds of brown horses, and then she's got that one white horse. It was a little on the nose, but it looked so good I forgave it immediately. It was so beautiful.
It's nothing but if not cinematic, this show.
Yeah. The rumbling sound that, you know, Adar and the villagers and Arendir started hearing was really fun. How they were like, what's going on? Mm. Where's that coming from? It reminded me, of course, of the Knights of the Vale in Game of Thrones, the timely entrance.
But I was surprised that Theo was put into the tavern, because he seemed to be the only one that had actually done battle with an orc before that, and he had this, you know, gigantic spear that he had. So I was surprised that he was not put on the front lines with the others.
I think Bronwyn was trying to keep him safe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I agree, he probably would have been a valuable soldier in that fight.
Mm.
Although we still don't know what effect the blood in the Sauron thing might have had on him. We did see Waldreg with the hilt and his arm was like super bloody. So the question is, does the sword hilt just need blood and it doesn't matter and it powers it and it doesn't really affect the person? Or is there some kind of connection now between Theo and Sauron? Unclear.
What a good question.
Well, I thought that, you know, when we see Arendir go to hide the hilt, and he looks at it, but he didn't follow him, but he knew where it was. So I wonder if after, you know, like the ring, that after possessing an implement of Sauron's, you have an intimate connection to it, that you can feel where it is, and you're still drawn to these dark objects.
Yeah, or because he was so attached to it emotionally, he followed Arendir and, you know, it's like the ring, right? The one ring. Frodo couldn't stand to be away from it for even a second. He would have certainly followed someone who was trying to hide it, even if he didn't want to.
I think it's pretty hard to spy on an elf, though, because they have good hearing, you know.
And they make no noise.
Yeah. For me, the explanation that Theo knew where it was because he has a connection to it, like the ring bearer's connection to the ring, it is the explanation that I prefer for why he knew where it was.
I think so too.
when Galadriel gets the bundle from Adar, and then she has like his blood on her blade, and then she wipes it on the bundle, I was like, no, blood activates it. What are you doing?
Like, yeah.
Of course, by then it was just a hatchet.
Yeah. That's right. At that point, it had been swapped.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, they're never really going to know what happened, right? Like they, the, all the people in that village are now, you know, having to deal with the volcano for whoever survived. Like they're probably never going to know that Adar switched the bundle and gave it to Waldreg, and that Waldreg turned a key in the destroyed tower that, you know, opened the gates. Like they don't know.
Unless Adar gives them some, you know, serious exposition in the next episode.
Yeah. Although they showed in all the chaos, it looked like Adar had somehow gotten out of his chains. They showed where he had been chained up and it was just empty. And I was like, we don't know what happened to Adar.
Well, I on my second watch, when Adar, I got the name wrong earlier, I think. It's called Morin for some reason. When he comes out with the hilt, he talks to the traitor from the village and he says, I need you to do a favor for me, basically. And then we cut away. So that was, I think that's when it got swapped out for the hatchet.
Right. Yeah. That's when the swap happened. Yeah. And that's why Adar took off with the hatchet to make Galadriel and the elves chase him so that they wouldn't go after the actual hilt.
Yeah. It's a really smart move because anyone who saw Waldreg like running away from the battle would be like, yep, he's a coward.
Yeah, yeah.
And not worth chasing him.
Yeah. But a couple of other things I liked was I liked that Valandil learned the lesson from Galadriel to like stab and then twist to disembowel the orcs, and he was learning that lesson. And another beautiful piece of swordsmanship was when Arondir missed with a thrust one of the orcs, but he came back on the backhand slice to take the orc out, which I thought was very elven of him.
Yeah.
Although he was fighting with his arm and not with his feet when he did that.
Yes, that's true. He was a little overbalanced, wasn't he, on that one? But he managed to recover.
Yeah.
And that's a question I wonder, because it is like, do elves just live their lives as if everything is in slow motion? Because, you know, Galadriel was able to avoid the arrow coming at her on the horse and to fall over to one side and then take them out. And you know, sometimes when we saw that original shot of Arondir catching the arrow and returning fire with it, I wonder if they just see everything moving slowly around them, like the Matrix or something.
Yeah, like bullet time.
Exactly.
I wondered that too. Like, do they have, you know, super speed in terms of vision? Because that also happens in like The Flash, and any time that there's super speed, the speedy person is like, everything's barely moving around me. like Quicksilver in the X-Men movies. And yeah, it's an effect. It's a cinematic effect I always really enjoy. The like, the world is still and this person is moving.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I never get tired of it. So I hope that's true and we get to see that.
Yeah.
Galadriel's move of like flopping over to the side on that horse and then still fighting was amazing.
Oh,
that was amazing.
One of the things I have in my notes is what money will buy you. In this case, horses. Lots of horses.
Lots of horses.
There have been other pseudo medieval fantasy shows that have not had enough horses, and this one it came up with the horses this time. And I want to give major props to Galadriel's stunt rider. She came all the way out of the saddle at a gallop twice in this episode, and that is not easy to do.
I was questioning how Galadriel had a horse that was so well trained to work with her and not freak out when its rider like flips around and stuff. But then Elendil has that whole talk with Isildur about these horses being special.
These special horses, yeah. I figure she trained it on the boat in the couple of days it took to come over.
And I think also if you just whisper a bit of Elvish to a horse,
that's right.
You can communicate with them. And I think that happened when when they were chasing through the forest, it reminded me of Arwen fleeing the riders in the Lord of the Rings, and it felt like almost the same location.
And
she whispered into the horse's ear to go faster, And I think Galadriel did the same when she was in the front of the charging army.
She did, and with exactly the same words. It's the same elven words that Arwen uses in the Fellowship of the Ring, and Galadriel uses in this episode.
Mm. And I love the callbacks to the films, and I'm so glad they kept most of the look and feel, because it does feel like the same IP, but they're done by different people. But they have enough respect for the movies that, especially with all the armor. I mean, the Numenorean's armor is just a thing to behold. That gold scale armor glinting in the sun.
Yeah.
Oh, and the ships. I can't go past the ships. I think they're just some gorgeous pieces of design. You know, I think they did great with that.
Yeah, and shooting the arrival as the sun is rising over the land was a really strong choice. And Elendil's talk about how he felt like he was expecting darkness wasn't at all foreshadowing.
No, not at all.
No. It was nice that Galadriel and Isildur got a minute together, because he always looks at her like she is some kind of goddess or icon, and which she sort of is. And I was glad that he got a moment to like see her as a human and not just a legend. I think it's going to have a strong effect on him in the future, his relationship with her.
And there was that bit on the ship where they were talking, and he said, I want the real Numenor. What did you think he was referring to? Was he referring to when the elves and men were together? What was your take on that?
I think it's linked to the whole the Western Shores business that's been so mysterious this whole season with him. And his mother drowning, that seemed really suspicious too, like the way that Elendil told the story and walked away. I think there's a whole history about, like, that Elendil's family, or maybe the wife's family, ruled in a different part of that island, and that's the real Numenor.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's the real Numenor that was allied with the elves rather than opposed to the elves. Yeah.
But I'm finding him a little bit hard to like.
Yes.
Yeah. Even down to the apple scene, I'm just like, he's munching away on that apple and he gives half of it. And then when he throws it out to sea, I'm just like, who is this guy?
Why did he do that? Why did he not give the rest of the apple to that poor horse? The horse would have loved to have the rest of the apple.
There was a lot of apple left on that apple.
I know.
But I think there's a bit of a trope in things when you have like the bad guy munching away on a piece of fruit, especially an apple, when he's expeditioning what his evil plan is. So I think it might have been a slight nod to that, but I was just like, don't throw away the apple.
Yeah. Isildur is not particularly lovable at this point. Right. He's a spoiled brat. I mean, when he wants to get on the ships to begin with, he says to his father, like, just jump me to the front of the line. No, I'm not going to do that.
No, but does that mirror his hubris later when we can spoil this, because that's at the cold open of Lord of the Rings, when he takes the ring for himself? I mean, is this just his character? Is this his real character, to be a bit unlikable and to be a bit narcissistic and want things for himself and to just expect everything?
Yes, yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
I hope we get to meet the brother. I don't think that in the books that there was another child of Elendil. I did some reading on it, and there was no mention of this brother. So I hope he comes into play, and that maybe he's like even more of a selfish twit than Isildur, and then we'll like Isildur better. I don't know.
Well, I think they're playing a little bit with unlikable heroes and likable villains. I have a lot of empathy for Adar. He's a bad guy, no question about it, but he's a complex bad guy. And Isildur's, he's a good guy, but I don't like him very much.
And I'm curious what happened to Adar. I would love to see more of how what happened to him to change him so.
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe at some point we'll get some flashbacks to, you know, the First Age and when Morgoth was taking over Middle Earth and corrupting elves and establishing his power. That'd be interesting. Or maybe there'll be another show.
Yeah. Well, there's 5 seasons, right?
Yeah. They got to fill 5 seasons.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping there'll be some flashbacks because I know I'm not alone in wanting to see some of that.
Yeah.
Well, there's things that have to happen as the season goes on. There's some rings to be made.
Yes. That's going to be very exciting. And I'm loving, you know, I know this was very focused on the Southrons and the Numenoreans, but I'm loving the dwarves and I'm loving the Half-Foots, and I can't wait to get get back to those to see how it all wraps up next week, because I think next week the last episode of this season.
There's two more.
Two more.
Oh, there's two more. Okay, good. I was wondering how they're going to fit it all in, to be honest.
It feels like it's going by really fast. I was like, wait, what? No. We're already at episode 6? That's crazy.
Penny, what's your second point?
Oh, we've sort of touched on a lot of my points, but let's talk about Hallbrand. We got a lot of interesting Hallbrand developments this episode. First, he is an excellent warrior. That move where he trips Adar's horse was beautiful. I was happy to see that the horse made it out of that alive.
Yes.
Unrealistic. Yeah.
But I mean, I've seen so many horses killed on Fear the Walking Dead that I'm really ready for some horse gentleness.
Yeah. Yes.
He was an amazing warrior. And then he gets, you know, above Adar and he says, "Do you remember me?" And Adar immediately assumes that he has hurt someone that matters to Hallbrand, right? He's like, if I hurt someone, did I hurt someone that you love? A woman, a child, maybe? And then Hallbrand is like glaring at him with a look that is hard to read. I mean, there's anger, but there's also like some kind of anticipation in his look. I'm not sure. And Galadriel has to keep him from killing Adar because she's like, we need him alive, which is something I'm in most TV shows. I'm always like, why don't they capture people and question them? And I'm glad that finally Galadriel was like, let's question him. Like, it's such an obvious thing to do. And then Hallbrand later just like freely accepts this legend, prophecy, or maybe it's just a hope that the people of the Southlands have had. That there's a king that they were promised.
I thought that skipped forward very quickly, and everyone's like, "Oh, you're the king now? Okay, yeah, great."
Yeah, and then they're all just like toasting him, and
Am I the king? Sure, why not?
And it's like he has this like charm on his, you know, belt, and everyone's like, "Yeah, he's the king. He has that little piece of metal." Like, I don't really understand.
What was that? Yeah.
And then the pouch with whatever is in the pouch.
Yes. What is in the pouch?
Oh, makes me crazy. And he's just like, I guess I am. I'm the king. It's a really strange scene. And of course, it ends very quickly when all hell breaks loose. But it's another like red herring. I don't know. Hallbrand is so hard to figure out. You never know if he's in it for himself, if he has noble intentions. But he and Galadriel have developed a real understanding of each other. You know, when he finds her in the woods later, and she's like, thank you for talking me down or holding me back. He's like, well, you held me back first. And he's sort of like, don't feel bad that you got angry at someone. And she's clearly thinking about the darkness within her at that point. Because, you know, Adar poked that bear. He's like, I'm not the only one who's dark.
So what was the aside that they did there, where he said, you know, I was in the battle and I saw you across from me, and there was that moment of connection. I wanted to hold that forever. Was there some sort of romantic inclination between the two?
Please,
I couldn't
no.
quite work that out.
Oh, please, no. No romance.
I was hoping not as well, but I couldn't work out what that was, or maybe it was just, being in battle together, you know.
Yeah, I think battle does a lot of strange things to your psyche. And that I've never been in battle, but I have heard veterans talk and they say that time both speeds up and slows down. And that in the middle of battle, there can be these moments of revelation and peace, and then you're back in it again. So maybe it was just battle craziness. I don't know.
And is it me, or is he looking more and more like Aragorn as we...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, his hairstyle is very Viggo Mortensen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he's definitely got that same, like, you know, square-jawed look of Aragorn. I think the writers know that, you know, millions of women were really into Aragorn, probably millions of men. And they wanted to give us some similar eye candy on this show and make him scruffy and dirty. I find him more attractive cleaned up and in the armor, but I know some people feel the opposite.
Like the dirty blacksmith, yeah.
Yeah. Or as a, you know, shipwrecked, mysterious stranger.
Yes, and the torn shirt and the wind blowing and the wet hair.
That was very, very romantic, those scenes, if it weren't for the fear of death. Parts of it. He is very handsome, but for me, Aaron Deere is like the most beautiful person on the show.
Yes.
He's just, I can't take my ass off of him.
Halbrand, he lacks Viggo Mortensen's charisma to my eye. I don't see him as an adequate Aragorn substitute.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe it's because there are so many other more interesting characters that I'm more focused on, and maybe I just I'm not taken by Halbrand.
Well, the moment when we're going back to the prancing pony, when we first see Aragorn across the room, you know, under a cloak in a dark room, it was just such a great moment. And you're right, I don't feel we've had that with Halbrand yet. But he certainly was much improved when he was in full armor and at full gallop and came to the rescue. I thought he did. But I still am struggling, well, not struggling, but I found his rise to power to be a little bit quick and unearned, whereas Aragorn's obviously, you know, going from Strider, the unknown king, to becoming king was such a long journey, whereas this one happened quite quickly, it felt.
And Bronwyn has been the leader of her people, and, you know, at least half of them have followed her, and then she just says, oh, dude, are you the king?
Right.
Yeah. Stranger who comes out of nowhere, you know. I don't know if she was just anxious to hand over the burden of being the leader, but to be a good leader, you would want to, I think, interrogate this guy a little bit more and find out, are you really the king that was promised?
Mm. Or is he just a puppet being thrust on them by Numenor?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Again, he has that little piece of metal and everybody thinks it means something, and I don't understand why it means something.
Mm. Yeah, I actually did a screenshot to see if I could zoom in on it and figure out what the drawings on that little bag he had was, and I couldn't figure out any meaning to it.
It's like wings and a heart or something.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of those Clada rings that you can get everywhere in Ireland.
Mm. Right.
How there's like a heart in the middle, but the wings on it, and it looks like it has like a stopper on the top. I couldn't make any sense of it either. Maybe the pouch is something. I don't know.
Hopefully,
but we shall see where things go with him.
Yeah, yeah. But hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about the meaning of that symbol.
Yeah. Mm. And I think Bronwyn is going to find that she can't just hand over leadership once people have started following her. She's going to be a leader.
Unless she's dead.
Yeah.
And Arendir is mourning.
There's that.
I really don't want her to be dead. I love her.
But I will say that the one thing that throws me every time is she has had, I think, the only bare arms and shoulders in all of The Lord of the Rings. Mm. And so I find her costuming a little out of place, but you know, different now that she had the shawl on. But in the earlier episodes, I'm like, she must be very cold because everyone is in cloaks and overcoats and long sleeves. But, you know, there were some bare arms.
She also has her dress is this like gorgeous deep blue, and all the other humans are wearing brown and gray.
Yeah.
She's costumed to stand out, but in a way that I find kind of unrealistic. I'm like, where did she get that blue fabric in the Southlands? Like, nobody else has that. And I know a little bit about, you know, how dyes and pigments are made and how expensive bright colored fabric can be, because when you don't have modern technology, making it is incredibly labor intensive and with rare materials. So I'm like, that's like a queen would wear that color.
Yeah, exactly. The purple of royalty is, you know, because it's so hard to make, that's the color of royalty. So unless she has her own blueberry patch somewhere.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, is it because she's a healer and they wear blue so that people can recognize them? I was making up a lot of stories in my head about why she had
That's why
dress.
We watch.
yeah, exactly. it gets the wheels turning.
Yeah. Oh, my headcanon has so many movies to make.
Yes.
I have a little bit lost track of where we are, but I think it's Rennie's turn.
Yes. So my last point is, boom.
Yeah.
So the forcing of the eruption of Mount Orodruin. Orodruin, that is a very hard one to say, is presented, I think, as a kind of terraforming to present to create a climate that's favorable to orcs. And one of Tolkien's themes was that he loved pastoral, rural landscapes like the Shire, like the England that he grew up in, the English countryside that he grew up in. And he saw industrialization as eating them away. So the trenching and the tunneling that the orcs did, that ultimately became the channels to carry the water to the mountain, looked like strip mining.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the sword hilt turned out to be more of a mechanical device than a magical device. And when it was turned, it activated what was in effect machinery to channel the water to activate the volcano. And so then all that bucolic landscape gets blown away by that volcanic eruption that produces ash and sulfur and air pollution, much as industrialization produces. So it goes from being Orodruin, a dormant volcano, to becoming Mount Doom, and creating this land of eternal darkness. And so I thought that the show was really presenting that idea of Tolkien's, that the destruction of the rural landscape by industrialization is a tragedy. Very well.
Mm. Yeah, I thought, and it was one of my last point as well, was it was such a visual feast, wasn't it, to see all the water come blowing down and erupting in the village and then suddenly pouring into the underground cavern with all the lava there and the explosion. And then gigantic lava bombs just raining down on everyone. And I think of one of the earlier ones, one of the Numenoreans just gets covered in this big blob of lava.
Yeah, he like disintegrates.
No
yeah.
And again, in this, like what I found was a very strange celebrational feast when, you know, half of the village had gone over to the other side and most of all died and the half that remained were all dead as well. But when all that came, it was very impressive and beautifully done, I thought.
I also enjoyed the reactions of the various people. You know, there was a lot of running around and people saying, like, take cover. And I'm like, where? How?
Where
do you go? Like, you're so close to the eruption. And there's, like, what are you going to hide in a thatched roof cottage? Like, it's not going to help you. you just stand where you are, kind of like Galadriel did, and wait and see what happens. Like, there's not... Yeah. I don't know where they were running people to. And they showed, like, Hallbrand and Arendir trying to, like, usher people. And I'm like, where are you ushering them to? I don't think there's anywhere to safe.
There was one line that you heard someone yell out, get behind the wall. But, you know, it's molten rock.
Yeah.
Coming at you at pace. And you can see in that cloud that's coming down the hill that there's fire in it. Mm-hmm. And all the oxygen in the air is just going to be mm-hmm. evaporated. And it was even without what happened to that on that volcano in New Zealand, tragically, a couple of years ago. It erupted and they died from basically all the air being sucked out of the air and burned up and sucked out of their lungs. And they all just died where they stood. And so I don't know how anyone, especially Galadriel, is going to survive.
TV magic.
Yeah. Yes. It would be a little bit disappointing if it is, you know, if they just get up covered in dust and go and brush themselves out and said, "Ooh, that was lucky," because it looked pretty violent what they were about to experience.
I agree. But we know at least a handful survive.
Mm. It's the how that I'm worried about.
Yeah
me too. Like, Isildur and Elendil were, like, close to the forest, and maybe that was further away or up a hill or something, and they could be covered, but the people in the village, it just seemed like there was nowhere to go.
No.
Unless maybe the orc tunnels ended up saving them. I don't know.
Well, the orc tunnels are flooded with water, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
That's probably not
Which
a good escape.
Which should be quickly turning to steam as
yes.
well in the reverse.
Yes.
Yeah, so the ground is erupting under their feet as well, mm-hmm. so... Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see next week. If they don't show us right away the aftermath of that, I'm going to be so upset.
You know they're not going to. We're going to, like, go back to the Harfoots or something.
Wandering through the countryside again.
Have some snails.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that goes nicely into my final point, which was just that the pretty stuff. I always like to summarize, like, the things that were particularly beautiful. And the eruption was one of those. It was unreal. And I got to watch it. I got home from vacation yesterday, and I got to watch it on my giant TV at home with the surround sound system I have. And it was spectacular. It blew my mind how giant the eruptions were and how beautiful and terrifying they were. The flooding as well, Jonathan, you were just mentioning what fun it was to watch the water, like, move through all these tunnels. And even though we knew it wasn't a good thing, it still had, like, a little bit of a satisfying feeling of, like, the flood gate is opening, and then watching the water went through and it was really pretty to look at. And we talked already about Numenor and the galloping at dawn and the sunrise at sea. But my favorite moment was when Bronwyn and Arendir finally kiss, and it's next to this, like, sort of crumbling stone wall and this really old, gnarly tree. And the shot itself was this, like, perfect paradise moment in between these two battles. It was really quite beautiful. Although tainted by my feeling that, no, if they kiss, somebody's going to die.
Yeah. Well, when she took those two arrows into her, I thought that there was she didn't have any chance whatsoever.
Yeah, that
those
was
hit very hard.
And one was very close to her heart.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's incredibly lucky, and I guess that's plot armor.
Yeah. But very, very gruesome for this show. And,
yes.
But I guess those seeds have some healing ability with them as well.
Yeah.
The seeds that they were going to plant in their garden together at least saved her life.
And then the cauterization, man, that was brutal.
Yeah.
I'm done with all my main points. I just have a couple of notes. How about you guys?
Yeah, I think mine overlapped everyone's because it felt like this is one big long scene. This
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So yeah, I only had another note that I really enjoy the character Ontamo. He's the third of the friends from Numenor, and how he was like, "That's enough battle for me.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah,
I don't want to do that anymore." And, you know, Valandil knew. He was like, "Isildur, I got us a spot on this expedition." And
I'm good.
Isildur's like, what about Antamo? And Antamo's like, no.
I'm going to help these fine people tidy up their village.
That was my only note.
So I have a note about the score. So I really, really want Bear McCreary to score my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know there's been some mixed reaction from people who are very attached to Howard Shore's score from the films, but I think this score adds so much to the show that is sometimes very subtle and sometimes not so subtle. This episode's battle scenes score, I thought, really played up the tensions of the battle. Mm. And the song last week, I thought, was really beautiful. So I've just really been enjoying Bear McCreary's music for this. And I'm impressed with Bear McCreary because he scored a number of different shows, and his work in each is very different.
Mm-hmm. So different. Yeah. I mean, what he did, The Walking Dead, right? And that's so different to what this is.
And Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica.
Did he as well. All right.
Yeah. Which is spooky and eerie music, but also somehow outer space. It's really good.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And I feel that he actually referenced, I was about to say the original trilogy, but you know what I mean?
Yes.
Lord of the Rings films with the, like, you know, there was a dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Mm-hmm. Just even the first two notes he brought into some of the music for this as the battle was about to start.
Yes.
I thought that was a nice blending of the two. And I love how they have respect, as I said before, for the Lord of the Rings films, because they are so close to all of us, I would think.
Yeah, yes. We all still love them. I think it's hard to understand how Bear McCreary has time to score all the shows that I see his name on.
Yeah.
I'm always like, oh, Bear McCreary, another show, Bear McCreary? Like, he just must work 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
anything else?
That's it for me.
I'm just checking notes. I think I'm good too.
Great. We're going to take a little break, and there's more to come. Stay with us. And we're back, and we have some news, an article from The Hollywood Reporter. Jonathan?
Yeah, it's by James Hibbard, and the headline is, The Rings of Power showrunners and a geologist explain that Mount Doom surprise. And it says, yes, water can make a volcano erupt. The Rings of Power showrunners and a geologist break down Episode 6's Mount Doom twist, which was based on more science than you probably thought. The 6 episodes of The Rings of Power concluded with a spectacular reveal of an iconic Middle Earth landmark, the volcanic Mount Doom. That mysterious sword young Theo discovered in the show's first episode has turned out to be a key that was used to open a floodgate, spilling water throughout those orc-dug tunnels. The resulting torrent stream fell into the bowels of an active volcano. The mountain's subsequent eruption as the water struck underground lava was like a nuclear bomb that turned the pastoral Southlands into what would eventually be known as Mordor. In a show that could easily have fallen back on using magic to accomplish a major terraforming twist like this one, see every episode of The Witcher, the Mount Doom reveal was a rather clever way of using an essential element from the natural world. Showrunners J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay say the twist was given considerable thought in the writer's room, which sought to tie the reveal into one of author J.R.R. Tolkien's biggest recurring themes. A huge theme of Tolkien is the environmentalism and the way machines and industrializations destroy the land, McKay says. We wanted that to be central and core to all and core all the time. It's a thing that comes up again and again throughout the show. So in the writer's room, we asked, what if Mordor was beautiful, all bucolic like Switzerland, and then what could happen that could transform it? We talked about the poisoning of the land, which starts in the first episode with the cow. Then you find out about the tunnels being dug and sulfur is going up in the air. It all builds towards this geologically realistic way of igniting the mountain, which now blacks out the sky for a very practical reason. Adar, our villain, sees the orcs as his people, and they deserve a home where the sun doesn't torment them. We're hoping it will take people by the surprise. Certainly did. But could the diverted water really have caused Mount Doom to explode, just like in this episode? Jeffrey Carson, professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Syracuse University, who specialized in volcanic activity and has written about the role of water in eruptions, overviewed the basics of the concept. How long of an answer do you want? Carson asked. We opted for the short version, which still ended up being a tad long. The basic idea is this. Water often plays a crucial role in causing volcanic eruptions, particularly when the volcano in question is on the sea floor. If a river poured into a land-based volcano like Mount Doom, mixed with the magma, and there wasn't a way for the resulting steam to exit, like, say, the incoming water was blocking the hole the orcs had dug, then there could indeed be an explosion.
Violent volcanic eruptions occur in large part because water is involved, Carson says. The water is dissolved in the magma. The magma rises to the surfaces. The water makes bubbles that can turn to steam, and the steam and water expand so rapidly that they basically blow the magma apart. That stuff piles up near a central vent, and that's what makes big volcanoes. That said, the resulting blow-up is more likely to be a steam venting explosion than a massive magma super vomit that lasts for centuries in Middle Earth. If that water is in a confined area, like a bottleneck, there's going to be a steam eruption. We call it a phreatomagnetic eruption, Carson adds. We see that happening in Hawaii all the time, where lava flows into the ocean, and some of the lava can get blown around if the water gets trapped under it. The professor did question our vaguely described scenario, wondering how anybody could dig a tunnel to a magma chamber when they tend to be at least 2 kilometers below the Earth's surface. For spoiler protection reasons, we couldn't explain to him that orcs are super industrious creatures known to be particularly skilled at extensive digging projects. Next week is the penultimate episode of Prime Video's The Rings of Power's debut season, which McKay was willing to tease a bit, spoiler-free. Like episode 6, it's directed by Swedish filmmaker Charlotte Brandstrom. We think that Charlotte Brandstrom, the director, and Alex Diesenhoff, the cinematographer, did an incredible job with the 7th episode, he says. You'll see who survives the Mount Doom eruption, and there are some unlikely pairings of characters. The episode is about consequences, and Galadriel is facing the consequences of her judgment.
Well, well, well.
Thanks, Jonathan and Rennie. That was fantastic. I love getting an actual scientist's input on these fantastical things that we sometimes see on TV and movies.
Yeah, all these shows are great when they're based a little bit in reality.
Yes, just a little bit, yes.
we didn't get any Facebook listener responses, but we did get an email from Evan Shapiro, and he says, "Hi all, I just want to remind you, as the Harfoots are considered as the ancestors of the sweet hobbits, that they are also likely ancestors to other more sinister hobbit-like creatures, including the murderous Smaugl. Even as a whatever he was before he became Gollum, he was still tricksy and dangerous. It may be worth recalling both potential fates when judging different individuals and not viewing them all as innocently naive. Sincerely, Evan Shapiro." Thanks, Evan. I'll keep that in mind. We have a couple of voicemails, and I'm going to play the first one from Anwen.
Uh-huh.
Hey, guys. Sorry I can't be with you this week. I'm away for a few days in Wellington, the home of Peter Jackson and Weta Workshop, and some might say the spiritual home of Lord of the Rings. What an episode! Can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about it. So much to talk about. Overall, I felt like it was very much like the feel of Helm's Deep, with all of the people waiting and waiting for these orcs to come and then fighting them. I thought it was really, really awesome. A few little callbacks that I wanted to point out. Arundi are trying to break the hilt, and he says, "It is beyond our skill to destroy." And that was just like Elrond says to Gimli at the Council of Elrond, "The ring cannot be destroyed, Gimli, son of Glóin, by any craft that we here possess." Then we have Galadriel saying, "Not a leam to her horse," just like Arwen does to Asphaloth in the Fellowship of the Ring. "Not a leam" means hurry up in Elvish. And when Adar is asking for the hilt, he says, "Why sacrifice their lives for such a little thing?" And that reminded me of Boromir, who says, "It is a strange fate that we should suffer so much fear and doubt over so small a thing, such a little thing." I thought that was really awesome. I really liked this clever shot that they did transitioning from the stuntman to the actor when Arundir's stunt double does this amazing roll off the roof onto the ground and an orc walks in front of him and then suddenly it's the actor. I thought that was so well done. And finally, Gail was right. It is a key. And the hilt was the key to Mount Flippin' Doom goes boom. I was amazed and literally blown away by that scene. It was fantastic and can't wait to see what happens next. See you next.
So I think that the title of today's podcast should be Mount Flippin' Doom goes boom.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, I'm on the road and I've only been able to watch this all on my iPad, so I can't wait to get back to my big TV and watch it all in its fine form.
Oh, you're going to be so excited. It's going to be amazing. I am really glad Anwen sent in a voicemail and not just a written note, because it was really nice to hear her voice this week. Thank you. And we have another voicemail. This is from Steve. I'm assuming it's a live Steving.
Oh, Cast of the Ring, this is Steve, and this is for episode 6 of The Rings of Power. And by the way, if I haven't said it before, I'll say it now. I really appreciate your podcast. It helps me so much to understand what's going on. This guy, this is Adar, right? This is the guy who is, we think, is a corrupted elf by the orcs. He didn't abandon the keep, right? Or watchtower. What is it called? What is this place called that they're entering? Okay, there's our guy. So they're going to attack him while they're inside. So they've got him trapped in that courtyard. And now they're going to, oh, this is good. So they destroyed the watchtower and now they have to protect the village. Do we have confirmation? Beric was the horse. Or is the horse, I guess. Yeah. Oh, this is a good conversation between Galadriel and what's the kid's name? The stable sweep. So this is Isildur. Isn't Isildur, wasn't he the one that cut the ring off Sauron's finger? You can't destroy this sword of Sauron. Okay, so the tradition is to plant one seed, but he gives her two. Ooh, the elf archer kissing the human female. Yeah. Oh, this is dangerous because, right, all the orcs haven't crossed the bridge yet, but wait, oh, they got the fire lit. Oh, they missed us. No, not with this burning cart that just hit you. Oh, wow, that last minute say is they're about to bust down the tavern door and then fight for the Southlands. Oh, this is not looking good for the villagers. Arondir, is that his name, is getting his butt kicked by this big gigantic orc and everybody else is getting hit. And then saved from behind by, what's her name? Now we hear the villagers cheering, so they must have pushed them back, I guess. Okay, so humans fighting with orcs, but where's Adar? Oh, so the first wave was just all the humans, and now the orc archers, well, are mostly human. The orc archers are just picking them off. Ooh, they're going to cauterize the wound on the Bronwyn. They got to do both sides, though, because it's through and through. Now this side, he said, okay. So the orcs have broken through. Adar wants the sword hilt, right? The Sauron's sword. Well, now the army from the ships is arriving, right? Ooh, so Galadriel is going after Adar. Wait, how is he able to, Halbrand, get around and to get in front of them? So this guy claims that he killed Sauron? Okay, so Halbrand and Adar have some sort of history, and now he's talking to Galadriel about it. Is that it? Just one battle and Numenor is going to go home? They think they're done? I don't know about that. Theo has just been given a great temptation here with this blade. Oh, but it's not the blade. It's an axe. Where's the blade? Okay, so this guy just unlocked something with a key, the blade, sword hilt, Sauron's what? Whoa, and we got a volcano. This is the creation of Mount Doom, Mordor. Wow, okay, bring on next week.
Thanks, Steve. I felt all the emotions
it's
again.
It's always a good ride
going through the whole
Steve.
Episode. Oh, that was wonderful. Oh, God. Thank you, everybody, for feedback. We love the voicemails, especially because there's such a nice energy to them. But any note or email or anything, we love it. Please keep it coming. Now we're going to enter the more spoilery section of the show that we call Galadriel's Mirror. So if you don't want spoilers, now is the time to leave us. And remember to check into podcastica.com to find out any information you want to find out about any of our podcasts.
Will you look into the mirror?
What will I see?
Things that were. Things that are. And some things that have not yet come to pass.
Anwen sent in her Galadriel's Mirror section, so we'll start with that. She said, I'm now even more sure Hallbrand is Sauron. If he is the king, why has nobody met or heard of him in their life? The Southlands isn't that big, and he only looks 30 years old. The whole king we were promised is too prophecy-like, as though it's been spoken of for hundreds of years. I don't think Adar has seen him in this guise, and Hallbrand was testing him when he asked Adar, do you know me? Then later, Adar says, who are you? And he paused before walking away. When he is with Galadriel and talks about wanting to hold on to the goodness, this fits with Sauron initially wanting to do good. This also works if he becomes the king of the dead, though. I love how Adar refers to that, too, that Sauron did at one point want to repent. I also love the moment when Hallbrand saves Elendil in battle. If he does turn out to be Sauron, it's a great piece of flipped foreshadowing, as we know Sauron later kills Elendil in battle.
Well, I have a very spoilery revelation for you. Are you ready?
Excellent.
I am Sauron. And I will be appearing in episode 8.
I knew it!
Man.
Oh my God. I would love it if they made Sauron a woman, though. Well, yeah. That would be amazing.
Sauron could be a woman and could also be an animal. Sauron has been a wolf and a vampire, and Sauron is a master shapeshifter. Unfortunately, most of that is actually from the Silmarillion, so they don't have the right to use it. But I'm kind of worn out with the show teasing us that Sauron could just be about anybody. Right. And so that's why I figured it just might as well be me.
It may as well. I think you'd make a great Sauron.
Thank you. Thank you.
I didn't know you had an evil streak, but it's interesting to find that out.
Yes, Jonathan has my number. So,
I'm not sure who else it could be at this stage.
Well, so the show's been making us wonder where Sauron is and hinting that it could be just about anybody, except maybe not Nori and Poppy, but it could be Meteor Man. It could be one of those three weird people who went and viewed the
meteor crater. Yeah.
Yeah. In this episode, I think they even teased that it could be Galadriel when Adar says, perhaps your search for Morgoth's successor should have ended in your own mirror. Right.
Yeah.
And since Sauron is a Maiar and he can take any form, he could pretend to be Galadriel. The real Galadriel may actually be somewhere else.
Yeah. She actually went into the West, you know.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. It wasn't
all
her
this
who
time.
Jumped into the water. That was Sauron pretending
to swim
to be
the Atlantic.
Her. Could
yeah.
be, yeah. So the predominant theory, it's everybody agrees with Anwen's theory that Hallbrand is Sauron. But I don't buy it. Because in the Second Age, Sauron appeared as Annatar, who was fair of face and a very persuasive talker who charms both Galadriel and Celebrimbor. And yes, Galadriel is kind of being charmed by him, but he just isn't smooth enough or charismatic enough for me to be able to see him as Sauron. I almost wish they'd swapped the casting because I think Joseph Maul, Uncle Benjen, who plays Adar, has much more of the capacity to be that kind of mysteriously charismatic character who I would see Sauron as. So there is evidence that he's Sauron. He does ask, "Remember me," when he has Adar pinned down. And if he is Sauron, he would then, the question he would be asking is, "Do you remember that you killed me?"
Right.
But of course, Sauron is, as a Maiar, he can't be killed. He just comes back in a different physical form. But there is another possible backstory, and that is that Adar did kill people he loved, as Adar himself suggests. And that may be why Halbrand became an exile and left the Southlands. And just before Mount Doom erupts, he says, "Yes, he is the king who was promised." I have such a hard time not saying the prince who was promised. "He is the king who was promised. And if he is the true king of the Southlands, then that could mean he's the king of Mordor, because the Southlands is Mordor. And that could mean he's Sauron. Or it could mean that he, in the future, he'll be a Nazgul. He will be one of the 9 kings of the humans who is given a ring by Sauron and ultimately becomes a Nazgul. And I think that's where Halbrand is going, and that Annatar has actually been around, has actually talked to Celebrimbor off screen, and we haven't seen him yet. That's what I'm hoping for.
Compelling interpretation.
Halbrand, to me, feels too small, so far.
Yes, yes.
He doesn't have the duplicitousness, the snakiness, the evil intent. He feels like he's on the run and happy to just to give it all up and become just a blacksmith in Numenor and make some money. But he doesn't have that gravitas, I think, that Sauron would just innately have. I'm not sold yet, but I still think it's you, Archmeister, I'm afraid.
That's the word, Jonathan, gravitas. That's what he lacks for me, is gravitas. And that's why I'm hoping that Annatar has been doing something in the background off screen and just hasn't been here yet. And maybe he won't appear until season 2, which I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I would be fine with that too. And Halbrand has just been like a fun red herring this whole season.
Yes.
That's got all of us talking and excited to watch the show. It's good writing.
Because they're giving us evidence that he could be Sauron, but they're also giving other plausible explanations for who he could be. We love a mystery. Speaking of the Nazgul, by the way, I think that that's Theo's fate. I think that he's going to be another one of the future 9 kings who gets a ring and becomes a Nazgul, because he is under the spell of the evil artifact, the sword hilt. And
I think the actor's been doing a good job as well.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes.
Theo?
Yeah.
The actor who plays Theo's great. Yeah.
Very believable.
Yeah. At first, I really didn't like him. I was like, who is this brat? And then he's really grown on me. And the way he loves and trusts his mother is really beautiful. Like that when he showed Arondir the hilt and then they both went to Bronwyn together, I was completely flabbergasted by that. I thought he was going to turn to the dark side and it was going to be this tragic loss for Bronwyn. And then to see him be like, "Mom, I have this problem. What do I do?" I was like, "Oh, that's so cute." I don't know. He's really grown on me.
And speaking of grown, is it just me or has he appeared to actually grown throughout the filming of this series?
Yeah.
I think when we first met him, he was a bit shorter, but now he was like towering over Bronwyn in his last one. But it might just be
his voice has settled as well.
Yeah.
In the first episode, his voice was a little weird. He must be that age where boys just like shoot up. And
that is the challenge of 14? Child actors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's how fast they grow.
Yeah.
I was watching an old episode of Stranger Things, and I was like, they're all 20 now.
Well, I had a couple of other observations.
Great.
Arondir says to Bronwyn that one of the Valar watches over growing things, and that would be Yavanna Kamentari, who is one of the Valar, also known as the Queen of the Earth. She is usually seen as a woman dressed in green, but also sometimes appears as a tree. And she is the one who persuaded Eru Iluvatar, who is the creator god in Tolkien's universe, to create the Ents to watch over the trees.
Oh, I love the Ents. I really hope we get to see them.
And that was another really gratifying part of the films of The Lord of the Rings, because the Ents could have gone so badly, but when you just see the eye open, it just gave me a big, big smile on my face when I saw that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Me too.
I love the Ents. They're I want to live in their forest. Mm. Like, it just seems like a lovely place.
This episode also makes a slight nod to one of Tolkien's own things he changed his mind about and wrestled with. And that is how the orcs were created. So Adar says, each one has a heart, a name. Galadriel says, a heart created by Morgoth. And Adar says, we are all creations of the one master of the sacred fire, the same as you. So the one master is Eru Iluvatar, the creator god. And so this exchange really points to Tolkien's change of mind. At one point, he did say that Morgoth created the orcs, but then later he decided that only Eru Iluvatar had the power to create life, and so he changed it to Morgoth corrupting elves to make them into orcs. So there is some muddiness about how the orcs were created, but it's Tolkien himself who created that muddiness. And Morgoth is a Valar, same as Yavanna, he was also known, his original name was Melkor, and he became known as Morgoth when he started doing evil things. And he's kind of like an archangel, and he's the one who rebelled against Eru Iluvatar. And Sauron was a Maiar, which is the next rung down from the Valar, who was Morgoth's lieutenant. And it was Melkor who created Orodruin, the mountain that became Mount Dune, in the First Age. Created it as a volcano, but it was dormant for all this time until this eruption.
I really like the fuzziness of the origin of orcs the more I think about it. And I think that it gives room to other interpretations of the legends, like, you know, thousands of years later, the legends are murky, right? About about these wars and you know, it might be that things did not go down the way that we thought, and that it wasn't as straightforward as we think, and that the legends have compressed and simplified things. And that, you know, I love that even within the elven race, right, between Adar and Galadriel, they don't agree on the origin of orcs, and they have different legends. She says, I was told as a child, and you know, it's what she heard from her people, and he lived a different experience. And it makes me wonder about all of the things we think we know about what's going to happen and what's to come, and how Sauron ends up on Mount Doom getting his finger cut off, that it might not be as straightforward as that, and we are going to find out and see how the legends are made. And I hope they leave some of that ambiguity and zigzags in there.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Adar did bleed black when Galadriel cut him.
Yes.
So there was an actual transformation, because he still seems so elven-like, you know, although a bit rougher around the edges now. But I found it very interesting where he did bleed black.
Yes, agreed.
Have we ever seen an elf bleed? Are they red-blooded?
Yeah, they are. I'm not sure we've ever seen one bleed, but we know that they are red-blooded.
Yeah, I can't remember on the walls of Helm's Deep we do see elves die there, but I can't remember whether they did bleed black or red. But I bow to your greater knowledge, Archmeister.
I'm pretty sure that it's only orcs who have black blood. And that's a sign of their corruption.
Corruption, yeah.
Yeah.
this has been fantastic fun, you guys. And thank you again so much for filling in and joining me on the Cast of the Rings. And Anwen, we miss you, but we are having fun.
Yes. Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
And everybody out there, thank you for listening and for your feedback. If you want to write in or leave us a message, you can find all our contact information at podcastica.com.
And while you're there, be sure to check out our other shows, especially Andor, which is on the Star Wars TV cast. I've really been enjoying doing that with my old friend James. He's got some interesting photo shoots coming up with some characters you'll be familiar with. But we'll be breaking it down, and it is, I think this is the darker, more mature Star Wars series we've been waiting for. And it's all about to kick off in episode 5. So join us.
Excellent. And of course, you can hear Rennie on House of the Dragon, Dragoncast, where she lends her deep knowledge to their book talk section. Mm. And it's really fun to listen to. The knowledge that you have is really deep. And Rima and Kristen ask really interesting questions. I love it, Rennie.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm really enjoying doing it.
What other podcasts are you guys listening to these days?
She-Hulk. I'm listening to your She-Hulk podcast.
Yay! She-Hulk is such a fun show. It could not be more different from Rings of Power.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have the two as a contrast. And Handmaid's Tale. Oh, so good.
And The Handmaid's Tale, yes. I couldn't get through The Handmaid's Tale without the podcast, I don't think.
Well, saying that, I haven't been able to get through Cobra Kai without the podcast either. It's been very essential, but that's been a nice palate cleanser as well, and great fun to listen to and watch. But I've been listening to the Cast of the Rings because I can only hold one sword and sorcery series in my mind at once. But so I look forward to catching up on the other. Yeah.
There's so much great stuff on right now that I am behind. I have not started Andor yet, but when I start it, I will listen to your podcast. And I'm really looking forward to that, especially since you're saying it is the darker Star Wars that we have all been waiting for.
Definitely more mature.
Like Rogue One was a darker movie.
Yeah,
Rogue One is my favorite. I did listen to your rewatch of Rogue One.
Oh, you did? Oh, good. Thank you.
I did. It was great. Because Rogue One is my favorite Star Wars movie of all time.
Oh, me too. It's amazing. And it continues on that in that vein. And everything makes sense. The world building is fantastic. And it really is fun to do.
That's great.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Next time on the podcast, we'll be covering episode 7. We don't have a title for it yet. And we'll see you in Middle Earth.
Mount Flippin' Doom goes boom.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get tender bone-in pork back ribs for $3.49 a pound with your card. Then get 16-ounce packages of juicy strawberries for $1.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.